What I'm going to do, I'm going to give a brief introduction about Chartism, where it came from, and then I will talk about the interpretations of Chartism. That's going to take up probably most of the talk. And we'll look at some problems of the interpretations that have been made, and then at the end maybe have a little look about the relationship of socialism to democracy and how that might sort of relate to today and the Socialist Party. So Chartism comes about largely as a result of the Great Reform Act of 1832, where the property get the vote. So everyone who's got property of households of more than £10 value get the vote. And it replaces a system which is much more... It's not a systematic throughout the country. So in some places, working men get the vote, and in other places, they don't. So actually, in some parts of the country, working men end up worse off. They don't get the vote, whereas the middle classes... To use that word. I know we don't use it, but I'm going to use it. People with a moderate amount of property do actually get the vote. And people have a lot of expectations. Working class radicals have high expectations of Parliament. They expect factory reform. They expect hours to be limited. That doesn't happen. An act is passed in 1833, and it's just extended to children, nobody else. And there was an expectation that it would, you know, that bill would provide some sort of way it would be applied to adults thereafter. And it becomes clear that that's not going to happen. It's just going to be applied to children. The poor law, up until 1834, it was an ad hoc system, a parish relief. A new system gets brought into being, where the one we would set up with workhouses and very harsh treatment. That comes into play in 1836 onwards, and a massive amount of disappointment from working class radicals about that. They were expecting it to be more lenient, it becomes more harsh. Trades unions, again, an expectation that trade union rights would be extended, that they would be treated more fairly. Actually, what happens is 1834 is a toll card on martyrs and Glasgow cotton spinners, that actually get treated worse. They're more harshly treated by the new parliament. Again, in Ireland, people expect that it's going to be more leniently treated. In fact, in 1835, I think it's 1835, you get an Irish coercion bill. And actually, again, one of the most... one of the harshest acts that's actually brought in during the course of Britain's sort of occupation, of home rule, British rule in Ireland, actually. It's the harshest piece of legislation that's ever brought in was in this new reformed parliament. Further suffrage extension. So actually, if the middle classes are asking for working class support to get the vote for themselves, to extend it to the moderately propertied, they expect, actually, they're going to want to extend it further. That's something that's going to happen. That doesn't happen. In fact, in 1837, Lord John Russell makes a speech where he says, actually, that's as far as it's going to go. And he gets the nickname Finality Jack for that reason. And the unstamped, at this point, after the Peterloo massacre in 1819, there's a tax put on newspapers, and obviously it puts it out of the price range of working class people for newspapers. So you have a large illegal unstamped press, and there's an expectation again that the new parliament, the new reform parliament, will get rid of that. It doesn't, it keeps it. So by 1836, you have a sort of build-up of working-class anger at the new reform parliament. It's been extended, but it's quite clear that the barriers the ladder's gone up, and no further radical reforms are going to be made, but in the interest of working-class people. So if there's going to be more suffrage extension, votes for working people, it's going to be working people that are going to have to get it for themselves. And they start to do that. They start to organise for that. And 1836, the London Working Men's Association puts together a bill that has 6 points to it. That's not very clear, but that's a bill poster from the time. And the 6 points are a vote for every man over 21, the secret ballot, because up until that point, ballots are held in the open air. Everyone can see how you're voting with all the, your employer knows who you're voting for, which is never a good thing. And end of property qualifications. So one of the major Chartist leaders, Fergus O'Connor, loses his seat in 1835 because he doesn't draw enough landed income. So he actually loses his seat for that reason. So the end of property qualifications to be an MP. Payment of MPs, because up until that time you have to have independent means before you can become an MP. Equal constituencies, because before then constituencies were vastly unequal, so the idea is to get industrial populations actually represented in Parliament. And six-point annual parliaments, and that's the one that people... Well, look, we've got the other five, but the last one, annual parliaments, well, we haven't yet got, whether we want it or not. But there's a principle of recall there, that basically, you know, if you're not happy with your MP, you can replace them much more regularly than you otherwise could. So pretty radical stuff, but it's put together by London Working Men's Association and some radical MPs. So it was designed to attract the support of parliamentary MPs and moderate radicals. So it's a campaign that basically we can get an umbrella sort of programme that everyone can agree on to extend it to the working class.
Extend the vote to the working class.
And it kicks off very, very rapidly. So you start up into, we take this bit of 1836 here, and that axis is kind of revolutionary potential or intensity. By 1839, you've got the real possibility of revolution in Britain. The authorities are worried. You've got a mass movement. Sometimes a council more meeting was estimated 100,000 people attended, so it's a really threatening movement. And there's a guy called Charles Napier who's given charge by the army, given charge of making sure that it doesn't kick off into being a revolution. And he's quite sympathetic. He's got radical sympathies. And he really doesn't want them to do it because he knows that he will massacre them. And he didn't need to, as it turns out. But the point is that 1839 is a tip when the most likely time to be a revolution in Britain. And the next sort of big time is 1842. And then the one that you hear about most often is 1848, the Kennington Common Meeting in London. That's the one you hear in textbooks on Chartism as being, you know, the big thing where the state gets organised, gets people, gets special constables organised and everything like that. But actually, by then, the kind of movement is on the downward slope, really. So the front of the movement is where the most sort of revolutionary potential is. And part of the reason for that is that there's petitions organised to Parliament, so the local charters are going around getting signatures on a ginormous petition to go to Parliament and to pressure Parliament into giving those 6 points of the charter. And that happens in 1839, in 42 and 48, provides a sort of organisational sort of focus for the movement. And at the same time, you have conventions, general conventions of the Chartists that come together in London, and also in 1839 they meet in Birmingham as well. Because of the Metropolitan Police comes around about this time, so they go to Birmingham in order to sort of get round the possibility of being arrested, and then they ship them up by the new railways to Birmingham and arrest them anyway. So it's the petitions and the conventions that sort of give those sort of peaks of organisation of the movement. So there's sort of four main ways that the movement's interpreted. The first one, not that one, but is sort of the Whig interpretation, which sees Chartism very much as being sort of a gradual process, and they're pushing too hard, basically. It will happen, but if you start demanding it, it's not going to happen. It's too threatening. So that's the kind of Whig interpretation. You've got the Tory version, which is, well, it's just a reaction to hunger and, the wealthy not providing for the poor, and therefore they're going to react in this way. So we've got to go back to our responsibilities. And there's people like John Fielden, the factory reformer, factory owner and reformer, and Reverend J.R. Stevens, and they're very much against the poor law and things like that. They see it very much as sort of punishing the poor for being poor, but it's very much a Tory response. The ones, and you don't really see those interpretations much anymore. They probably stopped in the early 20th century. The ones you do get that take up from there is similar to the Whig interpretation. It's a Fabian interpretation, or Fabian and Labour interpretation, which sees Chartism as sort of split into two wings. And on one wing, you've got William Lovett, the guy up there, that's William Lovett, London Working Men's Association, and Fergus O'Connor on the physical force wing over there. And the guys, they're associated with different things. So on the left-hand side, it's peaceful, radical, rational. They're very much moderate tone. They're trying to attract middle-class support as far as they can around those 6 points. And on the other end, you've got Fergus O'Connor, who has mass, you know, it's very much the focus of mass meetings, the mass movement. The Northern Star is his newspaper, which has got mass circulation, and uses the rhetoric of physical force. And he doesn't mean it, but what he's saying is, you know, peaceably if we may, forcefully if we must. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't really mean it forcefully, but it's rhetorical. But it, you know, said in front of 100,000 people, that's quite a threatening thing to say. And so they're the two main wins. And the early historians who were from a Labour or a Fabian background, people like Mark Hovell, they very much emphasised that side of the movement, the moderate side of the movement, and said, you know, these guys were good. If the movement had just been based around these guys, you know, it may have been able to get the vote quicker than if, the, you know, than out of the movement as it turned out, which was around O'Connor, which was threatening, and therefore, you know, MP, you know, you lost the support of radical MPs, you lost the support of the middle classes, so it just damaged the movement. It was never going to work from that point onwards. So that's the Fabian interpretation, and that kind of continues up until around about the 1950s, occasionally up into the 60s maybe as well. A guy called J.T. Ward is like that. And then you get sort of Marxist interpretation. This is from the 1920s onwards with Theodore Rothstein, people like that, and carried on to this day by sort of SWP and these types of people. And they see the movement as having sort of a mainstream, a sort of middle bit, where most of the support was around O'Connor and that physical force, that forcibly, peacefully if we may, forcibly if we must. Then you've got these guys, London Working Men's Association, people like that, and they're put so far, they more or less considered liberals and not really Chartists, you know, they don't even talk about those guys. The guys they're really interested in are people like George Julian Harney there, Ernest Jones, Peter Murray McDowell, people like that, and they very much see them as proto-communists, insurrectionists, the people that really float their boat. You know, they see those guys as being similar to them. You still find that. So if we take a recent one, this was published in 2009, second edition is, and so very much an emphasis on, you know, Newport Rising, one chapter, 1842 general strike, confrontation of 1848. So they concentrate on those peaks of unrest, you know, the revolutionary peaks. And again, John Charlton, the First National Workers' Movement, that kind of tells you everything you need to know in the title. It's very much emphasising the fact that the National Charter Association, which comes about around O'Connor, their sort of first real sort of working class party, and so they like that, the idea of that, and the revolutionary potential. And another example, David Black and Chris Ford, I think SWT members or spin-offs from those. 1839, the Chartist insurrection, and again that they're interested in the revolutionary potential that the movement has. So that kind of on the far left, if you will, is still the interpretation that you'll get today. There's Fergus O'Connor. And a new bunch of people come along from the 1960s onwards around the figure of Dorothy Thompson, the wife of Edward Palmer Thompson, E.P. Thompson, yeah. And she comes along, gets an academic post early in the 1970s. And she comes up with a... Lenin.
That's not Dorothy.
Sorry. This is going back to the SWP. Oh. So I digress. I've jumped forward a bit. So if we go back to the SWP and all those guys, they judge it very much in terms of how much, you know, how each leader is sort of compared to Lenin. You know, why did they fail? Well, they just weren't good enough revolutionary leaders. And so they'll talk about, they like O'Connor because he tapped into and fueled working class unrest and got the movement going. And you know, the mass circulation of the Northern Star and the support of the National Charter Association, they get the first National Workers' Movement. And they attack, you know, he attacked attempts at alliance middle class radicals, so this is all good from their point of view. But, you know, he failed because he doesn't turn these, you know, revolts in 1839, 40, 42, and he doesn't manage to turn that into a revolution, therefore he must be a really rubbish revolutionary leader. So that's kind of the focus, because they're looking at it through the sort of Leninist lens. And then we get on to Dorothy Thompson, and she calls, she says in her 1984 book, The Chartists, and I still think this is probably the best book written on Chartism, so published in 1984, cheap second-hand copy, you know, on Amazon and elsewhere. And she says, O'Connor was so much the centre of the movement that had the name Chartist not been coined, the radical movement between 38 and 48 must surely have been called O'Connorite radicalism. Now, he is central to the movement. Everything outside of O'Connor is kind of outside of the movement. And she, you know, says, you know, it's a gentleman leader. So there's a sense in which he takes over from people like Henry Hunt, who's of the Peterloo years, of the outside platform, mass support, populist support, and also the fact that he's, you know, supports the National Charter Association and it supports him, and the fact of land reform. But generally speaking, SWPers don't like that. That's because they say it's backward looking. You know, it's not. You know, it's fighting against the tide of capitalism. It's pointless. Where she sort of says, no, you've got to understand him in his own terms. This is very much an attempt to give independence back to working women. Is that we've all got an allotment of a couple of acres, 2 to 4 acres. We don't need to go to work, do we? We can feed ourselves. So therefore, you know, it must be, you know, literally she writes that. And so quite different from the conventional Marxist interpretation. But she herself, background, was in the Communist Party of Great Britain. But like Edward, her husband leaves in 1956, the Hungarian Rising, and sort of drifts slowly over towards, well, by the 2010 election, she was voting for the Liberal Party in this country. This little pamphlet by David Goodway, he sort of says that by the end of her life, she sort of came to regard herself as a Tom Paine liberal. So she's very much not a communist anymore. So there's a sense in which, you know, taking the Chartists on their own terms, instead of sort of looking at it through the lens of that Marxist, you know, how Marxist were they or how liberal were they, and sort of judging them according to that. Let's look at them and be sympathetic with what their aims were. So we're not getting that, we're not looking at it through a sort of teleological point of view. But if she's ended up sort of Tom Paine liberal, it look, you know, to me it's more like, you know, in being so interested in the Chartists, they kind of influenced her, and that she ends up sort of back at the point of she retreats from sort of communism in the end to liberalism. So she starts off as a Marxist historian and sort of ends up kind of being a modern Chartist. It's kind of weird. A couple of problems I'm going to talk about today to do with that analysis, because you'll find that everywhere. Today, anyone who writes about Chartism will take that Dorothy Thompson point of view, which is to say they'll look at O'Connor as being absolutely the centre of the movement. Anything you know, more liberal than that, we'll see in a minute, is outside of the movement, is not part of it. You know, people like George Julian Harney, the physical, real physical force guys, who kind of semi-believed that you could have an insurrection. They're kind of secondary leaders as well, and kind of outside of the mainstream. And that the real, you know, without O'Connor, there is no movement, is essentially that position. And you'll find that today in historians like Malcolm Chase and people like that. There's others as well. David Goodway, he takes this, even though he's an anarchist rather than a Marxist, he takes that view. Who else is there? There's a few. Anyway, most of the ones you pick up that aren't sort of SWP and all that, they'll take this sort of point of view. But there's a few problems. And I want to look at the London Working Men's Association and whether or not we consider that, you know, are they really middle class? Are they really outside of China? Is that fair? The first one, O'Connor sort of, he starts off, the movement builds up a sort of an alliance between sort of O'Connor and people like that, London Working Men's Association, the Birmingham Political Union, which has got Thomas Atwood, he's an MP, currency reformer, and the sort of movement built up as a coalition of all those people. But as time goes on, O'Connor, you know, becomes more and more popular, and he has a go at the London Working Men's Association, and he says, he compares them unfavourably to people with unshorn chins and blistered hands and fusty jackets. And he says that the London Working Men's Association are people that belong to the fine arts. He does more real work in a week than they perform in a year. Well, I can't get too seriously because O'Connor is after an Irish kind of landlord. But he's drawing this distinction. He's saying they're outside. You know, you're the focus of this movement. I represent you, people with unshorn chins, blistered hands. And these London, you know, upstarts. They're all sort of belong to the fine art. They're all well-off tradesmen compared to you sort of poor northern factory hands. Problem with it is that the Chartism as a movement is basically a radical political reform. It's not. It starts off as being a charter, a parliamentary bill that was designed to attract the support of the middle classes. It was designed to attract moderate support, designed to get radical MPs to vote for it. So to then turn round and say it's middle class is kind of pointless. It is by its nature designed to attract as much support as possible around a common umbrella programme. So in that sense, is it middle class, is it moderate? Well, the whole movement is kind of that is the basis of the start of the movement, so that's not really fair, in my opinion. The second point is that the London Working Men's Association doesn't allow non-working men into it. It starts off very much with you go to the minutes of them in the British Library and you read through their minute books. What you don't get a sense of is a really middle class, liberal kind of moderate group who are just dying to sort of get middle class MPs to sort of get their support. They're not lying down. So, we really want your support. What's the minimum programme we can put you? They're not doing that. What they're doing is they're getting sort of the maximum programme that they can put together to get their support, if that makes sense. So, and they don't let property into it. So radical MPs aren't allowed to be members. They're allowed to be honorary members. And O'Connor becomes an honorary member because he's property. He's not allowed to become a full member. So there's a sense in which they are, if you want to say, first working class political party, you're kind of, these guys are kind of it as well. So to call them middle class, I don't think fits with what they're trying to do as an organisation. They're trying to say, we're only working men can be in this organisation because we don't want to sell out. And the other one, and you'll like this one, is that they don't believe in leaders. And they said that we have not wished, neither do we desire to be leaders, as we believe that the principles we advocate have been retarded, injured or betrayed by leadership, more than by the open hostility of opponents. And that's pretty much a direct swipe at the mass platform. That's saying people like O'Connor, well, they're great as long as they say what we're saying, but, they can sell us out. So we need to organise ourselves and we need to, put all our faith in ourselves as a group of working class politicians. And the fourth problem is that you've got O'Connor, who believes in land reform, giving sort of working class people access to allotments and all this sort of stuff, which is kind of reactionary, where it kind of is, you can't get away from that. The idea that somehow or other giving, as with the land colonies that get established in 1847, they eventually get a scheme together and there's places established like Great Dodford in Birmingham. Where was the one?
Herringdon.
Yeah.
Charterville, outside of Oxford.
There you go. Yeah, and so they get established, and they end up becoming market gardens. People don't, look after and have pigs. You spade husbandry because you love ploughs. O'Connor was convinced that spade husbandry was the way forward. Return to I don't know, it's just bizarre in some sense. But, is this a viable way for the working class movement to go forward? And it just isn't. I mean, the very fact that they end up becoming market gardens, Great Dodford becomes market gardens, concentrating on strawberries for the Birmingham market. It kind of tells you all you need to know. And so if we compare that to the London Working Men's Association, where most of those are Owenites, and the reason they want to get, the vote in the first place is so that the working classes can obtain their political rights. And until they get that, cooperation upon Mr. Owen's comprehensive plan can never be successfully established. And that's Henry Hetherington, prominent member of the London Working Men's Association in 1832. So the point of getting the vote is that we can start to do things which are going to benefit the working classes. Not that I'm saying that Owenite socialism was the way forward for the working class, but it does show you that compared to O'Connor, they're more sort of forward-looking. They're not looking to get rid of industry. They're not looking to go back to spade husbandry. This is forward-looking stuff. So before I move on to that. So I think the idea of putting the London Working Men's Association outside of Chartism, just because they disagreed with O'Connor, because O'Connor didn't like them, is quite unfair. And you can already see from what you've seen on here that they're against leaders, they're for working class self-organisation, they're for Owenism. to call them, to label them middle class, as people like Thompson have, is you know, it's plain wrong. Because of their language, it's easy to do, because they talk in sort of terms of respectability and so on, so it kind of looks like they're a bit elitist, but they're not. James Bronte O'Brien, however, is considered by many to be sort of the arch proto-socialist. This is as close as you're going to get to socialism until the late 19th century. But, you know, O'Connor falls out with him as well. So this guy ends up being outside of the Chartist movement, even though he's sort of, you know, the furthest sort of left that you could possibly get in the movement. And he's responsible as the editor of the Poor Man's Guardian in the early to mid-1830s. His sort of language very much before that of the problem in politics being too much taxation and corruption. This is the sort of language. We want to reform Parliament so we get less taxes and it's less corrupt and costing us less money. And that's the sort of critique you get of Parliament. And he sort of moves. He changes that language to being, well, there's a, between capital and labour. There is a difference in interest between those of capital and that of labour. And he starts to build that up. And you can see that that would appeal to socialists later on, looking back at him. But he's also an Owenite. So he believes, again, like with the London Working Men's Association, that manhood suffrage is a way towards the government, possibly, he says at the bottom, manhood suffrage, would at once enable him, Owen, to submit his system to the test of experiment under the most favourable circumstances he could rationally expect. So when we get universal suffrage, we can expect Parliament to vote through funds or assistance in that and other forms for working class people to set up experiments along the lines of Robert Owen's sort of ideal communities. Probably not very realistic, but you know, that's what they hoped from the vote, or what O'Brien hoped for as well. And he had at first an alliance with O'Connor. He said, if you want middle class support, they've got to come to us. We're not going to go to them. We've got the mass platform, we've got our demands. If they're going to support us, all well and good, but we're not going to sort of try and go to them sort of asking for their support. You know, the principles are there, they've got to come over to us. And in the early days, he's in alliance with O'Connor, and he writes for the Northern Star, he writes under the pseudonym, you know, Bronte, some very sort of famous editorials where he talks about the conflict between capital and labour and all that sort of stuff. So, he's no shrinking violet. But, and this comes to a central point, what do you do once your petitions have gone into Parliament and Parliament have rejected them, laughed them out of the House in 39, 42 and 48, what do you do? How do you react? And there was talk of a general strike in 1839, doesn't happen. O'Connor goes to ground when they eventually try it, doesn't really work. And hence, he's always criticised for his lack of leadership, because they say, well, he should have sort of taken command of that, turned the general strike into a revolutionary movement. He doesn't. He's no interest in that at all. That peaceably, forcibly, if we must, is pure rhetoric. He doesn't want to go that far. It's purely the threat itself is what he thinks can get them the charter. So he's never intending to be an insurrectionary in any way whatsoever. But what do you do once you've failed? And 1842, Bronte O'Brien says, well, okay, we tried this twice, doesn't really work. Maybe we need to sort of moderate our language. Maybe the mass platform's kind of not the way to get democracy. If people feel threatened by us, maybe we need to sort of make it clear that we don't really want the revolution, we just want the vote. And we're not threatening, we're nice people, we're respectable. And he goes over to something called the People's Charter Union, which was started in Birmingham by a guy called Joseph Sturge, very much he's a propertied factory owner and radical. And he starts to say, O'Brien starts to say things like, you know, the danger is that we're seen to be moving too fast. You'll move before your friends, i.e. the propertied, you know, if you're more moderate, they'll come over to you. And for that, O'Connor gets, you know, he writes some leaders in the Northern Star, which sort of says, you know, O'Brien, well, he was all right once, but now he's become middle class. Look, he's gone over to these guys. He's no good at all. He's he's a traitor to the movement and so on. And so O'Brien comes to the similar conclusion to which the London Working Men's Association, he starts to become sceptical about the idea of leaders for the reason that he's been the victim of O'Connor. And he starts to say, well, the National Charter Association is all right, it's fine, but it becomes very much, whether you're a good Chartist or not depends on whether you're loyal to O'Connor. And the minute you do anything that sort of goes that O'Connor doesn't like, you become sort of branded as middle class, as outside the movement. And he starts to say things like, the National Charter Association is no good, it's all right, but we don't want to be man's tools. Well, prominent men, distinguished men, but we don't have no leaders, no dictators. So I think he considers himself to be, a prominent man and a distinguished man, but not a dictator or a leader such as O'Connor is. So if we look at legacies of the Chartist movement, we see that sort of O'Connor might be considered to be the last gentleman leader of the mass platform. It doesn't happen again. You don't really have a leader with mass outdoor meetings. That sort of populist thing dies away with O'Connor. So 1848 is kind of the last time that actually happens. He does have the biggest mass circulation newspaper probably ever. Probably in the Northern Star, a circulation at its peak in mid-1839, of 60,000 a week. So it's just phenomenal. It outsells the Times. It's phenomenal. Great achievements. And, Dorothy Thompson, in what she's written, her history, where she sees him as so important, I think it is an advance on the kind of sort of Socialist Worker Party type history, where you're just looking at the proto-communists and sort of trying to elevate that and look at why the revolution failed. I think there's something, she tells more of the real story of Chartism than they do. He's a really impressive leader in that sense. But, in terms of, if you're looking at it from the point of view of steps towards socialism, if you will, it's a question of personal loyalty. So if you're a good Chartist, you're loyal to O'Connor. And we've seen that London Working Men's Association suffered from that, and O'Brien did. And there were loads of others. Virtually nobody who was prominent in the Chartist movement didn't fall out of O'Connor at some point or other. So you've got personal attacks and the isolation of other prominent Chartists. His land colonies failed and they became market gardens, as I've suggested. So, in a sense, there's a kind of Tory element to O'Connor. It does feel like the last of something that had gone before it. It doesn't feel really, when you look at it, like something that the later working class movement could kind of take anything from that's particularly useful. The London Working Men's Association, on the other hand, has got sort of this emphasis on working class political independence, emphasis on political knowledge, and the social democratic use of democracy, and it's got its anti-leadership position. And, as socialists looking back, that seems to me to be somewhere on the way to where we are. On the minus side, there should be a kind of minus sign under there. They have got this tone of sort of respectability and elitism and the need to be sober and not to irritate people and so on, which can be a little bit irritating. And that, there's a sense in which O'Connor can label them as middle class and people see it as convincing because, they've been irritated by that tone. And they've also got, they've not got a sense of class, of separate working class interest and a capitalist interest. What they've got is an Owenite faith in rational choice and social experiment, so that if you get the vote, you will be able to argue the rational case for a different way of doing things, and rather than a sort of balance of class forces kind of thing, they believe that just arguments can win the day. We don't need to have class struggle. Good arguments are good arguments. If we get the vote, we're going to get social experiment, and then we will see which is best, and then we'll slowly merge into the sort of Owenite paradise of idealised communities. That's kind of not really realistic. Bronte O'Brien, he's the one that's sort of associated with that phrase Chartism and something more. That's something more sort of usually being associated with socialism. That's a plus for him, his legacy. And he combines, just like the London Working Men's Association did, he combined the need for social reform explicitly with political reform. So political reform was to get social reform. That was the point of it. And he does bring about, more than the London Working Men's Association, he does develop a language of a labour interest against that of capital. And you get, when you get the Social Democratic Federation founded in the 1880s, it's O'Brienite radicals that feed into it. They keep going. There's these O'Brienite people that consider themselves to be sort of followers of O'Brien. It, you know, persisted the 1850s, 60s, and 70s as old men, and eventually feed into the Democratic Federation when it gets established, which kind of is a direct line to this party in some ways. A negative side, he's got a political understanding of exploitation, so he doesn't really develop that idea of labour against capital. It's all, when you get the vote, it's just enough that you'll have more working men, electors than you will have propertied, and that will be enough to make it act in the interest of everybody. There's that. So you don't really get that sort of sense of a real understanding of what's behind exploitation there. It's kind of limited. But as you can see, the London Working Men's Association and O'Brien next to O'Connor do look a lot more forward-looking than O'Connor does. You know, but we can see from the historians that are sort of prominent now, they've written O'Brien out of the movement and they've written the London Working Men's Association out of the movement because they see them as middle class. And O'Brien was very much in touch with the movement. The minute he goes over towards the People's Charter Union, the middle class radicals, he's then outside of it again. The last thing I want to talk about is that relationship with democracy. If you want to achieve democracy, they're not doing it on as Owenites or as social reformers. They're saying, well, we need the vote first and foremost as a means to achieve those things. When we get it, we can do it. We can start to think about actually achieving those social reforms. Without representation, we've got absolutely no chance whatsoever. And in getting it, we are going to need to try and persuade people that we haven't got revolutionary intentions. Or if we have, they're only going to come into being, down the line. You haven't got to worry about it now. And so they play that down. They don't talk about their attempt. They don't talk about themselves as Owenites. Don't talk about themselves as social reformers. They talk about themselves in terms of how far they can agree with middle class radicals in extending the vote. Because the middle classes are interested in extending the vote in order, as industrialists, to strengthen their hand against the landed aristocracy at that time. So it's a chance to achieve an extension of the suffrage by cooperation. And there's a kind of link with the SPGB in that sense as well, in how it's talked about the relationship of socialism to democracy. What do we do if we end up in a situation where there's no democracy in this country, or in the case of the Spanish Civil War and Eastern Europe in the early 90s? And, do we support democracy on its own terms? Do we support democracy as a good thing? Or do we just stand for socialism? And the party's taking very much the view that it's a means to an end. You kind of need it before you can achieve socialism. And in this sense, the London Working Men's Association is pointing this out in 1837. It said we need to bury the question of what is the best aim for society in order to agree on the fact that we need democracy. Make sense? Okay, so that kind of concludes my thought.